Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secret. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, over the past few weeks, United States military forces in Afghanistan have quietly abandoned their military bases across the country, signaling the end of America's 20-year war there. My colleague, Thomas Gibbons Neff, has been reporting on what it actually looks like as the U.S. leaves. It's Thursday, July 8th.
Is that a helicopter above you?
Yeah.
It's pretty loud.
Yeah.
Do you hear that all throughout the day and night?
Yeah, well, the Americans are supposed to not fly from like 9 at night till 8 in the morning, but they've thrown that out the window with the withdrawal. So yeah, it's pretty much, I sleep through it. But yeah, we're right underneath the flight path to the embassy.
Right. I guess it's like white noise at this point.
Yeah.
Well, Tam, what exactly is the state of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, which you just hinted at this point?
Right. So the state of the withdrawal at this moment is that it's almost complete. But looking at this moment and how we got here, I mean, the question is, what does the end of a nearly 20-year-old war look like?
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
You know, in mid-April, President Biden announced that all American forces or the war effort would end by September 11th.
President Biden ordered U.S. troops to begin their withdrawal from Afghanistan starting today.
After 20 years, U.S. and NATO are aiming to withdraw thousands of troops by the end of the summer.
Ending America's longest war.
Now, what that's looked like since then has kind of been this moving target. I think it's a question that everybody asks, what does the end look like?
The U.S. is leaving very, very quietly. All of the troop movements are practically state secrets. They're not advertised.
It was such a lack of transparency on the American military side. And increasingly, since the beginning, the press has been monitoring the closure of these bases across the country.
With little fanfare, the massive air base that served as the anchor of America's two-decade-long war is now in Afghan control.
Bagram Airfield, once home to 38,000 U.S. troops, now nearly abandoned. The fighter jets gone, nearly everything gone. This is what
closures of these bases that have names, Bagram, Dwyer, Kandahar Airfield, that resonate with the hundreds of thousands of troops that have rotated through here. They're little mini cities where, you know, lives transpired, people died and were shipped home. These base closures is how much of the American public is charting this withdrawal, this end that Biden set out to accomplish by September 11th.
Well, what does it actually mean for the U.S. to walk away from a base? What does it look like?
So I visited one base in Helmand Province about 2 weeks after the Americans had left or handed it over to the Afghan security forces.
Mm-hmm.
So this base is called Camp Shorab. It's kind of this little base that sprouted up in the last few years as the Americans tried to recommit forces to advising the Afghan security forces, specifically the Army.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, you're a former Marine. Before you were a Times journalist, you served in the U.S. military and were in Afghanistan. We've talked to you about that in the past. So I assume that you've perhaps spent time at a base like this one?
I did. So I spent time there in 2008 and 2009 when I was a Marine.
Mark, Dave, say hi to the camera. I'm doing what's going on. Here we go. More cots and tents. There's a post over there.
When I first showed up in Afghanistan as a Marine, it's not that we were staying in a city or a town. We were staying at these installations, which kind of became our homes.
That's Mills' dinner. Mills, put it in your mouth. Put it in your mouth. Put it in your mouth. Oh, yeah. That's a garbage.
And it's kind of, for me, it was all these different moments of my, I guess, young adulthood, especially in the beginning.
Here's my rack, my radio, my M16's over there, and that's about it. Until next time.
And my first encounter was this kind of barren installation that was getting larger as the war effort grew.
And when you say larger, how large did your base get?
As far as the mileage, I mean, I think you could run around the perimeter a couple times and it'll equal 10 miles. I mean, to me, in my head, it's, you know, these sprawling tan structures and fireproof tents and post exchanges and motor pools and helicopter pads and landing strips, you know, all bustling. This is right as Obama started his big surge. So it was this hive of activity and launching from the base were airstrikes and medical evacuation missions.
How many people do you think were on a base like that in its heyday?
I mean, well over 10,000, I would assume, with contractors and the troops rotating in and out.
So what you're describing very much sounds like a miniature city.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what these places were. They had mess halls and chow halls and internet centers and phone centers and post exchanges where you can buy energy drinks and, you know, little tchotchkes to send home to your mom if you wanted to pay the postage. And I spent Christmas there in 2009. You know, we had stockings from the USO up over our cots. Mm-hmm. It just kind of felt like this different universe that we had kind of walked into this. I mean, the heart of a war, I guess.
So let's talk about what it looked like when you returned a few weeks ago after the U.S. had left this base. When you walked in, what did it look like?
So we walked in where there was a couple Afghan soldiers guarding the gate, and they let us in, and it was the base kind of as I had remembered it from a few years ago. There was the motor pool. There was some vehicles that the Americans had left behind, off-road ATVs. I think there was a Land Cruiser. And walking around, I kind of just felt like at any moment somebody would open, you know, a door and they would pop out, you know, in uniform going from A to B. But it was totally quiet. You know, the outdoor gym was still, you know, there was dust over it at this point, but there's still weights on the weight racks. All the first aid equipment was still there in case there was a rocket strike. You know, there was little engravings on the tables. The porta potties were still there, soap in the soap dispenser. And then we walked to the barracks or these living quarters. I guess they're called container housing units, these boxes. And walking in there, the bed frames were upturned. Stickers had been scraped off the walls. But there was some evidence of who had lived there just by how it smelled.
What do you mean?
One room smelled like Axe body spray. The other room smelled like someone smoked a lot. You know, it was almost as if it was still warm. It felt like they had left but were coming back. One of the last places we went to in the base, you know, I had wanted to see the chow hall, because I had sat there as a reporter in 2016 and in 2017 talking with soldiers and Marines. And, you know, inside the mess hall that was unlocked. It was one of the few buildings that wasn't locked. The lights were off and we couldn't find a way to turn them on. So we had our headlamps that we turned on, and, you know, it said Shorab DFAC, you know, dining facility. And it was like today's menus. And there were just these empty little folder holders where the menus would have been. You know, we went to the freezers that were still cold. The Americans had left enough fuel in the generators to keep the food from going bad, so the Afghan troops could take the food. You know, the fuel for the American military, you know, sodas and pies and cookies that were really good, and and mozzarella sticks that I had a hankering for. And as we walked through, you know, the serving stations were wrapped in saran wrap, and the lights kind of reflected on it. And it just felt post-apocalyptic, you know, the end of a movie, you know, this idea that this is it, you know, this is the war, kind of saran wrapped in an empty, dark dining facility.
It's very ghostly.
Yeah, it felt kind of haunting. I mean, we're always looking, I think, right? I'm a reporter, I'm a veteran. Like, we always look, especially now at the end of it, you're kind of looking for these moments that can say this is the end, you know, like an open casket funeral, I guess, to say goodbye. And I think definitely that dining facility will be logged as one of those memories.
Well, I want you to say more about that. I mean, what did it mean to you, particularly as a former Marine who served in this war, to see a base in this, as you said, post-apocalyptic state, just kind of frozen in place, no longer occupied by your fellow soldiers?
Yeah, I mean, it was an outer body experience, right? Experiencing something that is so simple, like a saran wrap serving station, an empty defac menu, a clock on the wall, and knowing that you're experiencing something that you'll have to process for a long time. I mean, that's kind of Afghanistan. It's the Hotel California you can check out, but you can't ever leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go through these very chaotic moments, I guess, in my early 20s, and then to link that to the present, you know, is important, right? Like, this is what the end looks like. You remember the middle and maybe the beginning. But now you have this moment where you can kind of close it out. So selfishly, I mean, I think it was really important for me.
Tim, you said earlier that the Afghans now control these bases. And I wonder what that handover looks like and what now happens to these bases.
Right. I mean, the handover of these bases has been kind of a mystery. You know, for some of the larger bases, they were handed over in the middle of the night. And it seems with a lack of complete coordination with the Afghan security forces, the American military would push back and say this has been extremely well coordinated. But at the heart of it, the Americans and, you know, quote unquote operational security concerns seemed inclined to not give the Afghan security forces their exact time of departure because there's a fear of, you know, some kind of attack or insider attack, or someone in the security forces might leak something to the Taliban, or a disgruntled soldier, Afghan soldier, would fire on the Americans. So I think it's played out a little disjointedly as far as that's concerned.
Right. And it sounds like these transfers are happening with no ceremony and no fanfare and some level of distrust for the people who are taking it over. And I have to say, although this was personally powerful for you to see as a veteran of the war, it all feels very anticlimactic, the end of these bases after a 20-year war, after all the blood and treasure that was devoted to it, to have such a rushed, disjointed, as you said, middle of the night handover of these bases from the U.S. to the Afghan forces.
Right, and anticlimactic is the word to use. I mean, the fact that this is kind of just quietly happening and the press has to kind of rush and find out that it happened to write their story, or, you know, to use it as a mile marker or a monument to the war, I mean, it is really underwhelming. I mean, I've, you know, seen a friend on Facebook kind of asking, well, when is anyone going to talk about this? When is anyone going to come out and say what this was supposed to mean, right? Because at the end of the day, I don't think anyone in Washington or in the military here really knows how to answer how does it end. So they just leave and one base closes after another and a press release goes out with, you know, 50% of the withdrawal is complete, 90% of the withdrawal is complete, because no one's been able to answer that question. I mean, everyone's kind of wrestling, myself included, you know, what that looks like or how that's supposed to feel. And I think the closest they've been getting is these closures of these bases that have kind of become monuments to the war itself, right? Because that's something you could point to. It's something concrete.
We'll be right back.
At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. You can go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada, or try out the Western trend with denim from Frame. You can shop Saks.com for everything on your agenda, whether it's a bright Amiri blazer for a garden party or a new Chloe carryall for your commute. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you think about the 2024 election, how do you feel?
Sickened.
Hey, y'all. Estead Herndon here, host of The Run-Up from The New York Times. And recently, I've been asking this question a lot.
I feel tired. I feel a little scared.
And I've been hearing the same sort of answer in reply.
We have an incompetent incumbent and a Republican that I'm not going to vote for. Yeah.
When voters look ahead to the 2024 presidential election, they feel apathy, dread, that it's just a mess. The Run-Up is your guide to that mess. Each week,
I am going to vote for the man with the most impeachments and the most indictments.
We'll talk to voters, elected officials.
I believe America can do for anyone what she's done for me.
And the candidates themselves, all to help you better understand this moment in American politics. The Run-Up is new every Thursday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We've been talking about the experience of these base closures for the American forces. I wonder how this is all sitting with the Afghan people, the U.S. leaving these giant installations that have become fixtures in their lives as well.
Right, and that's a question that I've had for some time. And I think one of the better examples of that handover would be Bagram Airfield, right? That was the Americans' biggest base. Twin runway, where basically it was the anchor of the American war effort. And I wanted to see, you know, how this base closing would affect the local communities. So last week, I went up to Bagram Air Base right before it closed, and I talked to people around the base to see how they felt about it closing.
Tim, I wonder if you can describe the scene that you found outside of Bagram Air Base.
So to describe the scene outside of Bagram, you kind of have to understand the airbase itself, right? And it was built in the 1950s as an airstrip that the Soviets turned into their hub for their war when they invaded in 1979. And then in 2001, when the Americans arrived, it was run down, kind of just the remains of a Soviet airbase. And throughout the years until the height of the war, I mean, the Americans built it up. They built another airstrip. There was a prison there that was extremely notorious. Two inmates died. And by the height of the war, I mean, there were tens of thousands of people there. There were pizza huts, shopettes, post exchanges. I mean, it was very much a city. And as the base grew, the town around it kind of fed off it. There was a local economy that was based off of the scraps and trash that came off the base. And there were people from the town who worked on the base as contractors who would commute every day from their homes and line up at the gate early in the morning and then walk on. And on the base, they would do odd jobs, laundry, maintenance, you name it. And then in 2014, as the base started to shrink, as American forces, international forces began to leave, you know, these contractors were fired, less stuff came off the base, less scrap, less material.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time that I visited it, you know, last week, it was very much the end of that chapter.
So we've just arrived outside the gates of Bagram Airfield. It's the largest U.S. base still in the country. It's the last base.
We had visited this row of shops, these brick and steel door. I guess it's really a shopping mall called the Bagram Shops.
We're here. There's, you know, lines of shops. People are kind of going about their day as if, you know, the Americans are still here. But on the other side of the walls, there's barely anything left. And
so, I mean, looking into these stores, I mean, the best way to describe it is you're kind of looking at the cross between a pharmacy and a Humvee trailer.
What else? Yeah, tourniquet, da-da-da, trauma shears, little pouches.
I mean, they have bathing supplies, shampoo, They have
spicy nuts,
food and energy drinks, mostly snacks, you know, little desk fans. Mm. I mean, just imagine an office and everything in your office as you move out that you don't really want or you're not going to take home.
What else? Oh, where did you get these little plaques from?
That's kind of what a big chunk of this inventory is, on top of the miscellaneous things that just seem really random, whether it's
a tourniquet.
You know, a tourniquet or a pair of trauma shears.
It's a meal ready to eat. What flavor is it?
A military backpack, a lone energy drink, what have you.
But like, who is the clientele for everything you're describing? Tourniquets, trauma shears, and also energy drinks and snacks. Is that U.S. soldiers? Is that local Afghan people? Who are these stores for?
It's whoever, you know, maybe people come from Kabul, you know, from nearby towns to buy these things that you can't really find anywhere else. Doctors or local shops or stores or you know, what have you that needs one of these items. It's just kind of this random grab bag of things that maybe you and I wouldn't think you'd ever need, but someone, you know, around the town of Bagram would at some point.
And so what did these shopkeepers say would become of their businesses once Bagram closed, given how reliant they obviously are on the base?
So I walked down this row of shops with another reporter, Fatima Faizi, and we talked to kind of one after another as we came up to the doors and poked our head in.
How's business been?
So it's getting worse day by day.
One owner said, you know, business is getting worse by the day and that, you know, the Bagram shops are going to have to be closed.
Has business been good lately?
Another said, you know, business was fine because more people were coming because the Americans were leaving and there was more inventory.
More stuff come out of the base and more people come out because they know Americans are leaving. They haven't come here to buy new stuff.
But, you know, once that goes, he might have to close.
Is he going to leave Bagram or?
So maybe I go to Charikar in the center of Parwan and start a new job.
And then, you know, one older gentleman who got very hesitant when I took out my phone to record and didn't want to use his name. You know, I had asked, he had a piece of body armor in his inventory. And he said something along the lines of, I'm not selling this anymore. This is for me, paraphrasing, because tomorrow there's going to be a war, right? Just very hesitant and afraid, you know, that the Taliban were getting closer and closer to Bagram and that he was going to have to use these things that were on the base to defend himself and his family. And how he conveyed that was hostile. He didn't know that I was American, but he felt like he was talking to someone who kind of represented the base, that I had put him in this situation. I think that kind of spoke to most of these shopkeepers, that there was just this sense of betrayal, right? That the Americans had left this puzzle, these 20 years of war without any resolution, the Taliban still running around the countryside, civilians dying from airstrikes. You know, nothing had really changed in the last 20 years except the Americans were leaving. That was the feeling, whether that's the reality or not. I mean, you could debate that for hours, but that was definitely how these shopkeepers felt.
Is he worried about having to fight the Taliban soon?
Yes, we have to. If they come occupy our land, yes, we have to pick up guns and fight them. And this is going to happen.
I mean, there's this distinct fear of the Taliban returning. You know, they're within 50 miles of Bagram and getting closer as they advance across the north and other parts of the country. But they're not just afraid of the Taliban, right? This idea that keeps getting floated around of another civil war. I mean, you could argue that, you know, Afghanistan's been in some degree of a civil war for the last 40 years. But as the Taliban get closer and everybody starts picking up weapons, you know, it's impossible to tell who's the good and the bad, who's taking out a local feud on someone or not, or what have you. So, I mean, this idea of militias rising up
of being threatened, not just by the Taliban and the government, but maybe by your neighbor, is very real.
Well, that makes me wonder, TM, on the ground, where you are in Kabul and where you were around Bagram, how much can you see and feel this rising sense of peril, whether it's in the form of the Taliban approaching, you said they're within 50 miles, or militias picking up arms and the country descending into civil war? How real is all that threat at this moment, given the state of the U.S. withdrawal?
Yeah, I mean, in Kabul, it's kind of like a bubble. You know, things carry on as you'd expect. I mean, there's this conversation of what comes next. I mean, that's all around the city on every street corner, absolutely. But I'd say the indicator that I've encountered that kind of telegraphs that things are getting bad and getting bad quickly was a recent trip to the passport office. You know, these are city blocks that looked like a street festival as far as the amount of people trying to get passports, families of nine, with people out on the corners with printers trying to talk through, you know, the paperwork needed to fill out the appropriate documents to get a passport to leave, go to Iran, go to Pakistan. And there's certainly some level of exodus happening. And I think, you know, again, it was very apparent down at the passport office.
So the best evidence that people are terrified is that people are trying to flee the country.
Correct. Yeah.
I'm curious how the U.S. leadership, in particular President Biden, is talking about this moment, the base closures, the U.S. leaving, and the terror that it is striking in the hearts and the heads of the people of Afghanistan.
Right. So, I mean, you know, looking at the April announcement, you know, this resolute President Biden saying, you know, we're ending the war in Afghanistan. You know, this is going to be it. We're going to be out by September 11th. And over the last, you know, few months, that narrative has kind of changed, where he's kind of trying to do two things at once. On one hand, he's trying to convey to the Americans, we're leaving. And then on the other, to the Afghans, he's saying, well, we're leaving, but we're going to keep supporting you. We're not abandoning you. We're going to keep, you know, giving you money for humanitarian projects, for the security forces. We're going to keep 650 troops at the U.S. embassy. And it's a line that I think is impossible to walk, right? Because there's still going to be that sense of abandonment in Afghanistan because the Taliban are taking broad swaths of the countryside. So I think in the next couple of weeks, or, you know, by September 11th, President Biden will have to find a way to deliver whatever that final message is going to be, that this is over or we're still going to be here helping the Afghans, just with not as much troops.
I always think back to 2001, to September 11th, and to the reality that the U.S. entered this war in order to try to take out the Taliban, which it believed was harboring Osama bin Laden, who planned September 11th. And now, 20 years later, the U.S. is leaving these bases just as the Taliban is surging towards all these key places and key bases. And that always makes me want to understand what that turn of events feels like to somebody who fought in this war. And you have fought in this war. And so I wonder how you kind of make sense of 20 years of fighting to try to take out the Taliban and then watching the Taliban gaining more and more power at the end of this conflict.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate question. That's the, you know, lie in bed at night and stare at the ceiling kind of question. And you know, you ask maybe the Pentagon and they'll say, well, we were there to make sure that there were no terror attacks, any more terror attacks on the United States from Afghanistan. And we accomplished that mission. You know, Biden will say, you know, the Americans killed Osama bin Laden in 2011. So we accomplished the mission. But as you said, you know, the initial invasion was to oust the Taliban, who had been harboring bin Laden. And fast forward all these years, you know, almost two decades, and like you said, they're achieving some level of military victory all across the country. And for someone like me who fought you know, it's pretty easy to stare up at the ceiling and say, we lost. I mean, that's as bad as far as I can get right now.
Well, TM, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll be right back.
Hey, Daily listeners. Did you know you can listen to your favorite podcasts ad-free on Amazon Music? With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free or visit amazon.com/thedailyadfree. That's amazon.com/thedailyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's what else you need to know today. The government of Haiti declared a state of siege on Wednesday after its president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated by gunmen at his home. The president's wife was also hurt in the attack, but is expected to survive. Four suspects in the attack were killed in a gun battle with police, and two others were arrested, but their motive remains unknown. The attack came at a tumultuous moment for both Haiti and Moïse, who has clung to power for the past year, even after many had argued that his presidential term had expired.
Tout le monde, tout secteur dans le pays, doit faire un seul pour condamner ça qui vivait.
In a speech, Haiti's interim prime minister condemned the attack and called for calm.
Gardez calme nous. Sécurité pays sous contrôle. Force vive nation.
Today's episode was produced by Luke Vanderploop, Rob Zipko, and Stella Tan. It was edited by Paige Cowett, contains original music by Rochelle Banja and Dan Powell, and was engineered by Chris Wood. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
With Schwab Investing Themes, it's easy to invest in ideas you believe in, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, electric vehicles, and more. Schwab's research process uncovers emerging trends. Then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals, all in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing.